daily, then on a weekly basis, in all sectors, trade, business, security, and even in some cases on the diplomatic level. All these issues are there. The two countries, Iraq and the Islamic Republic of Iran, have been proactive in reaching agreements which would be to the interest of both republics.
Is there any side that opposes this partnership or strengthening these relations between Tehran and Baghdad? Iraq is honestly under pressure to diminish these ties.
Honestly, so far, no one has put any pressure on me or the government of Iraq not to take these steps. However, we do take into account very seriously, and our policy also is to take into account the interest of both countries and cooperation in sectors where there is an interest for both countries for the sake of mutual cooperation and mutual interest.
After the budget was ratified by the Iraqi parliament, there continues to be controversy over this budget. The government has also appealed concerning certain articles in the budget. What is the position of the presidency and the president in light of this controversy, and how will you sign this budget after it was ratified, and how will it affect the situation as a whole in Iraq?
First of all, having a budget is necessary for any country in order for it to implement its programs and pay the salaries of the workers. That is one part of the budget. Another point is that there is always, in all countries, especially if it is a democratic country, there is also debate over the budget. There's no budget plan in any country which is complete and 100% accepted by the cabinet, the parliament, and even groups outside of parliament. I personally, in the name of the presidency, have signed the budget, and God willing, we will begin implementation in days from now. There is no problem in this regard. The most important issue in this debate is the implementation of the budget plan. But we have begun implementation of the cabinet's program when it comes to services and improving the infrastructure of Iraq. And that is the most important thing for the people of Iraq.
The relationship between Kurdistan of Iraq and the central government has not always been at its best. There were times of differences and, in some cases, lack of trust. What is the position of the president from these differences, and how is your relationship with the Kurdish Democratic Party? Also, there are internal differences between the two major Kurdish parties. Some fear that this threatens the unity of Kurdistan and could lead to separation of the region of Kurdistan into two parts. I mean, Erbil and Soleimaniye. How do you look at all this?
First, the relationship between the region and the center is good. True, in some cases there are varying viewpoints, different demands, and this is necessary. And we declare it, and meetings between both sides are continuous. And now we have also agreed to the budget of the region of Kurdistan, and there is an agreement on importation of petrol and on the income of Kurdistan. All this is there. Relations between political parties, everyone knows, no two parties see eye to eye. Not all parties have the same ideology. Of course, there are differences between the Kurdish parties, as there are differences between the Iraqi political parties, and this is needed. Legitimate competition between political parties, I believe, is for the interest of society. But looking at differences as deep divisions, which would lead to separation, is a bit exaggerated. And a group of people don't understand what the situation is in reality. We are working for the sake of coordination and cooperation and to serve the Iraqi society in the current circumstances. And cooperation between the Kurdish region and the center continues daily. I am not far from the situation. I am in contact daily and continuously to strengthen the relations and improve relations to implement the program of the region as well as the program of the central government.
In your opinion, Mr. President, will this government continue for 4 years, or will we perhaps witness early elections? What would occur of the agreements between the factions while forming the cabinet? Can we say that the situation is at its best since 2003, meaning your relations with Mr. Sudani and the government in general?
The relationship between the government and the presidency, and even with the parliament and among the parliamentary blocs in general, is very good. Our efforts now are focused on implementing the program of the cabinet, especially after the approval of the budget plan, in order to give services and improve the infrastructure in Iraq and to become self-sufficient in some areas which are necessary, such as the issue of nutrition, health, and even water. We are working on these aspects, and our hope is that we can improve these sectors, which are a priority in our program. And the change of the cabinet is one of the priorities. We are working on the current plan for the government and hope to implement the plan in the near future. And 4 years is not a very long time in the age of any people. It is the parliament that decides when the elections would take place, and the government decides when there will be elections, or the president would decide when we are in need of holding new elections.
As the main protector of the Constitution, there are calls which we hear every now and then on the need to amend the Constitution of Iraq, since it is said that it's static and that some points are missing, issues which are supposed to be in the Constitution. Some saw this in the issue of the formation of the cabinet, which took more than a year.
The issue of the Constitution did not have anything to do with the formation of the cabinet.
Well, how does the President see the issue of amending the Constitution? Do you see that it is necessary, or perhaps this can be postponed?
First of all, my answer is that there is no constitution in the world which implements all the points related to the needs of society. In some countries, there is no constitution at all. Therefore, now we are implementing the constitution of Iraq, and until now, there has not been any opposition to the constitution from any side in Iraq. True, we might need some changes or switching some terms for other words. For example, in the beginning, when we approved the Constitution, we had the presidential committee for the country, the president and two vice presidents that form one committee. Now we have a president of the republic, and there are several other issues which are noted. In my opinion, these issues are, for the time being, secondary issues. Now our focus is on strengthening security and stability, as well as implementing the program of the cabinet. After all, if we have some problems in the Constitution or the law or legislation, we will have time to think about them and to work on it based on our Constitution or based on our current laws.
The system of governance presently in Iraq is parliamentary, based on the parliament. But there are some calls demanding that change to a presidential system of governance. Considering the current circumstances, can such a system be implemented? What are the components that would oppose a presidential system, and what's your position?
In the current situation, I don't think this is applicable. Maybe one individual here or there is calling for such an issue, but for now, our focus is on what I have said, implementing the Iraqi Constitution and the current legislation in addition to the current program put forth by the government.
How are the ties between Baghdad and Washington during the current government? Do you have a plan to visit Washington? In general, how are relations between you and the U.S.?
Relations are good with Washington and the Americans. It is not something we hide. We have good relations and there is cooperation, and we have visits to Washington at the level of officials and delegations depending on the need and necessity. But the most important thing I want to focus on is that we preserve and defend the independence of Iraq on all levels.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the U.S., federal prosecutors have asked a judge overseeing former President Donald Trump's election interference case to bar him from publicly disclosing some of the evidence gathered during their investigation. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Justice Department has asked the federal judge overseeing the criminal case against former President Donald Trump in Washington to step in after he released a post online that appeared to promise revenge on anyone who goes after him. Prosecutors on Friday, 4th of August, requested that the U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan issue a protective order concerning evidence in the case. A day after Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to charges of trying to overturn his 2020 election defeat and block the peaceful transition of power, the order, different from a gag order, would limit what information Donald Trump and his legal team could share publicly about the case brought by special counsel Jack Smith. District Judge Tanya Chutkan on Saturday gave Donald Trump's legal team until 5 p.m. on Monday to respond to the government's request. Trump's legal team, which has indicated he would look to slow the case down despite prosecutors' pledge of a speedy trial, then filed a request to extend the response deadline to Thursday and to hold a hearing on the matter, saying it needed more time for discussion. District Judge Tanya Chutkan swiftly denied that extension request on Saturday evening, reaffirming that Donald Trump must abide by Monday's deadline. Protective orders are common in criminal cases, but prosecutors say it's particularly important in this case because Donald Trump has posted on social media about witnesses, judges, attorneys, and others associated with legal matters pending against him. Prosecutors pointed specifically to a post on Donald Trump's Truth Social platform from early Friday, 4th of August, in which Trump wrote, in all capital letters, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." Prosecutors said they're ready to hand over a substantial amount of evidence, much of which includes sensitive and confidential information, to Trump's legal team. They told the judge that if Donald Trump were to begin posting about grand jury transcripts or other evidence provided by the Justice Department, it could have a harmful, chilling effect on witnesses or adversely affect the fair administration of justice in this case. The protective order, proposed by the prosecutors, seeks to prevent Donald Trump and his lawyers from disclosing materials provided by the government to anyone other than people on his legal team, possible witnesses, the witnesses' lawyers, and others approved by the court. It would put stricter limits on sensitive materials, which would include grand jury witness testimony and materials obtained through sealed search warrants. A Trump spokesperson said in an email statement that the former president's post is the definition of political speech and was made in response to dishonest special interest groups and super PACs. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, a former assistant public defender nominated to the bench by President Barack Obama, has been one of the toughest punishers of rioters who stormed the Capitol on 6th of January 2021, fueled by Donald Trump's baseless claims of a stolen election. The indictment unsealed this past week accuses Donald Trump of brazenly conspiring with allies to spread falsehoods and concoct schemes intended to overturn his election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. The indictment chronicles how Donald Trump and his allies in what special counsel Jack Smith described as an attack on a bedrock function of the U.S. government repeatedly lied about the results in the 2 months after he lost the election and pressured his vice president Mike Pence and state election officials to take action to help him cling on to power. Donald Trump faces charges including conspiracy to defraud the United States and conspiracy to obstruct Congress's certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory. National broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. Federal prosecutors on Friday, 4th of August, asked the judge overseeing former President Donald Trump's election interference case to bar him from publicly disclosing some of the evidence gathered during their investigation. In a court filing, attorneys with the special counsel Jack Smith's office requested that U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan ensure that sensitive materials are used by Trump's defense team for only the trial, and that the former president view the materials in the presence of his lawyers. All the proposed order seeks to prevent is the improper dissemination or use of discovery materials, including to the public, they wrote. Such a restriction is particularly important in this case because the defendant has previously issued public statements on social media platforms regarding witnesses, judges, attorneys, and others associated with legal matters pending against him. Donald Trump, who was arraigned on Thursday, 3rd of August, on charges that included conspiracy to defraud the United States, pleaded not guilty and has publicly condemned the allegations against him. Prosecutors went on to say that Donald Trump had written multiple posts that mentioned or implied the case, including one that appeared on his Truth Social page on Friday afternoon that read, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." Donald Trump's use of details or grand jury transcripts obtained in discovery could have a harmful, chilling effect on witnesses or adversely affect the fair administration of justice in this case, the prosecutors argued. In a statement early on Saturday, 5th of August, a Trump spokesperson said, "The Truth Social post cited in is the definition of political speech, and that it was in response to the rhino, China-loving, dishonest special interest groups and super PACs." During Thursday's court hearing, Magistrate Judge Moxilla Upadhyaya gave Donald Trump a warning that is not typically issued to defendants at arraignments. The magistrate judge said, "Finally, sir, I want to remind you that it is a crime to try to influence a juror or to threaten or attempt to bribe a witness or any other person who may have information about your case or to retaliate against anyone for providing information about your case to the prosecution or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice." District Judge Tanya Chutkan has ordered Trump's attorneys to respond to the government's motion for a protective order stating their position on the matter by 5 p.m. on Monday. They are expected to respond much like in the other cases in which Donald Trump has been indicted.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The crisis in Niger is deepening even further as defense chiefs of West Africa's regional bloc agree on a plan for a possible intervention in the West African nation after the military junta there failed to restore civilian rule following last month's coup. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has given the junta 1 week to reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum or face the potential use of force. In a statement after their meeting in Nigerian capital Abuja, ECOWAS said the bloc has taken all necessary measures for a military intervention in Niger.
All the elements that would go into any eventual intervention have been worked out here and being refined, including the timing, including the resources needed, and including how and where and when we are going to deploy such a force. We are determined to stop it.
The bloc said it is seeking democracy in the African country.
Military is not our option of choice. It is the last resort. We want diplomacy to work, and we want this message clearly transmitted to the leaders of the junta in Niger that we are giving them every opportunity to reverse what they have done and to return the country to constitutional order.
The decision to militarily intervene in Niger has been welcomed by France. In a statement, the French Foreign Ministry said it firmly and resolutely supported efforts by ECOWAS to reinstate former President Bazoum. The ministry added the future of Niger and the stability of the entire region are at stake. An ECOWAS delegation has also arrived in Niger's capital, Niamey, to hold talks with military officials in an effort to reverse the coup and restore the former president. In a separate reaction, Washington also said it supported ECOWAS leadership on Niger.
We strongly support the very strong leadership of ECOWAS on Niger. I don't want to get ahead of where things are, but what ECOWAS has done in terms of stating very clearly that there's an expectation for return to the constitutional order and a continuation of the democratic process.
The United States has also suspended some of its aid programs to the government in the West African nation. The developments in Niger comes nearly 2 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blocked access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdelrahman Tiani expressed support for the coup and said its priority was to avoid destabilizing the country. In an instant reaction, ECOWAS urged what it called constitutional order to be restored. The union threatened sanctions if Niger's coup leaders failed to reinstate the ousted president. The sanctions by the ECOWAS were met with angry reactions from opponents of the pro-West former regime.
Closing borders for a country like Niger is not a good thing for a landlocked country, but we're trying to adapt. Like Mali, we're not going to die. I believe that Niger exists and will continue to exist, whatever the decision taken by ECOWAS. What I have to say to ECOWAS is that it must be for the people, not against them. So it's a system that we denounce.
But apart from all the sanctions, what has created concern among many people across Niger has been the idea of a military intervention there. It stressed that Niger belongs to Nigerians and that they will support the military in face of any intervention.
As Nigerians, we said to ourselves that if the military decided to intervene in the situation, we would be with them all the same, and we're determined to go wherever they want, and we're not even in favor of negotiations. Niger belongs to the Nigerians, so in this sense, we ask only one thing. We ask only one thing. We're asking for the withdrawal of the French from the French military base for them to go home. And we are with our soldiers today because the military are the ones defending us.
The possible military intervention in Niger also drew reaction from Russia. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it is unlikely that interventions by some non-regional forces can change the situation for the better. As for us, we are monitoring the situation very closely. Of course, we are concerned about the tensions that are now growing in the region. We remain in favor of Niger returning to its constitutional norms as soon as possible without any damage or threat to human life. Putting all the factors together in Niger's recent military coup and the subsequent reactions, what comes to the spotlight is the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians, as many of them say. Given that people of Niger have been fed up with decades of French rule over their country, what seems to be of high significance for the external powers is that they must stop intervening, either politically or militarily, in Niger, and let the people of Niger decide their own future.
A new documentary produced by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement revealed that Palestinian resistance fighters managed to infiltrate Israel's Shin Bet, a spy agency Mossad. The documentary titled Spider's Web 2 details a complex espionage operation that was carried out against the Israeli organizations by Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance movement of the Islamic Jihad, which is headquartered in the Tel Aviv-blockaded Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. The documentary illustrates the espionage enterprise, which involved six Palestinian fighters and was part of a wider operation launched by the Islamic Jihad in 2022 to retaliate against Israeli warfare in Gaza. The Israeli military launched close to 150 airstrikes against the coastal sliver during the war, prompting the resistance to respond by firing some 1,100 rockets toward the occupied territories. The Palestinian agents reportedly baited a number of Israeli officers into revealing secret methods and procedures. One of the Palestinian operatives, referred to as Recruit 106, duped a Shin Bet officer into believing that he was afraid of being arrested by the Palestinian resistance fighters, thus luring the Israeli officer into revealing a treasure trove of information on the regime's security system, methods, and tools. The Palestinian agents also managed to find out how Shin Bet agents had, in the past, tried to pose themselves as Palestinian Authority officers, Jordanian intelligence agents, and even a European Union representative on one occasion. According to the documentary, the Palestinian move led to the detention of several agents working for Israel and the dismantling of at least three Israeli spying centers. The successful conduct of the operation, according to the documentary, led to the Al-Quds Brigades debunking the myth of might that surrounds the Israeli regime and its capabilities, with the Palestinian fighters identifying the regime as no more than an illusion made of dust. The term was famously used by Mahmoud al-Arida, one of the six Palestinian prisoners who successfully escaped an Israeli maximum security prison in September 2021. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, which took power in late December, has thrown Tel Aviv into unprecedented turmoil with its push to overhaul the regime's judicial system. Many of the former senior officials present at the December conference have become highly public dissidents, warning of the damage to Israel's security by the agenda and even supporting the refusal by thousands of military reservists to serve the regime. By every metric, the Israeli economy has suffered, while scientists, doctors, and tech entrepreneurs either prepare immigration plans or march in the streets alongside hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. The Israel Medical Association said nearly 500 doctors are expected to leave Israel, warning that the exodus can lead to a severe medical crisis. Israel is no longer as strong or as stable as it was mere months ago. Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz recently warned of a worrying security situation across the occupied territories amid a months-long wave of anti-regime protests sparked by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet and its contentious policies. Last week, after Israeli parliament passed the first of the judicial overhaul bill, sparing mass protests, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah described it as the worst day in the history of the Zionist entity. He said, Israel has embarked on a path, God willing, of collapse, fragmentation, and doom.
Top rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S.'s credit rating over its rising debt and a, quote, deterioration in the standards of governance. Fitch is one of the big three rating agencies. It has dropped the credit rating to AA+, down one notch from the highest rating AAA. The lower credit rating could over time raise borrowing costs for the U.S. government. The lower credit rating provides investors with a guide of the risks associated with investing in the debt of a particular country. The move could cause investors to sell U.S. treasuries, leading to a spike in yields that serve as references for interest rates on a variety of loans. Fitch has pointed to the expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years, a high and growing general government debt burden, and the erosion of governance relative to other countries with similar rating over the past 20 years. Fitch predicts a growing government deficit, noting that the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio was currently at 100.1%, 2.5 times higher than the AAA-rated country's median of 39.3%.
It is important. It is relevant. The question is, of course, is it the canary in the coal mine for other similar downgrades? And I would say, is it a lagging or a leading indicator? I mean, this dance around the debt ceiling goes on year after year where we're quite familiar with it. It's not a surprise. It was actually less drama this time around than before. So why is it now that the governance has been called out? I do think it's significant that it's been compared to other developed economies because the governance, is it demonstrably worse here in the US than other developed economies? Or is this just, it may perhaps it falls short of what it should be?
Fitch has also cited the Federal Reserve's recent credit rate hikes, weakening business investments, and a slowdown in consumption to predict a mild recession in the fourth quarter of 2023 and the first quarter of 2024. The decision was viewed by observers as another embarrassing blow to the U.S. government, which had long been rated as one of the safest borrowers in global finance.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is a steady deterioration that we've seen in some of the key metrics for the United States for a number of years. Debt to GDP in 2007, general government debt was less than 60%, and now it's 113%. So there's been a clear deterioration. Furthermore, we're expecting fiscal deficits to rise over the next 3 years, and we expect debt to continue to rise over the next 3 years. And furthermore, because of the higher interest rates and the higher stock of debt, we're now seeing the interest burden rise pretty fast, actually, in the case of the United States. So the underlying numbers are, especially on the fiscal and debt side, are quite negative.
Fitch's downgrade comes roughly 3 months after U.S. President Joe Biden signed a deal to raise the debt limit, just days before the U.S. was expected to default on the national debt. The last time the U.S. credit rating was downgraded was in 2011, following a similar budget showdown that came within hours of the government defaulting on its debts. The reputed credit rating agency has warned that the growing debt, which is now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way pose threats to the country's creditworthiness. Both administration officials strongly criticized the rating cut. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the decision was arbitrary and based on outdated information.
Its flawed assessment is based on outdated data and fails to reflect improvements across a range of indicators, including those related to governance that we've seen over the past 2.5 years.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Fitch's decision defies reality when the U.S. had the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world. But U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the country's credit rating by a notch from AAA to AA+. An index designed to track turns in U.S. business cycles fell for the 15th straight month in June, dragged down by a weakening consumer outlook and increased unemployment claims.
marking the longest streak of decreases since the lead-up to the 2007-09 recession.
But the bigger picture, Fitch has exactly right. We are on an unsustainable fiscal path. The ultimate consequence probably isn't a missed Treasury payment, but it's probably a disastrous run of inflation when we try to monetize a debt we can't afford.
The Conference Board, which is a leading business membership and research group organization, has reiterated its forecast that the U.S. economy is likely to be in a recession from the current third quarter to the first quarter of 2024. Elevated prices, tighter monetary policy, harder to get credit, and reduced government spending are poised to dampen economic growth further. Since inflation is still higher than the Federal Reserve would like it to be, policymakers are widely expected to raise interest rates by another quarter percentage point. These rate increases make it more expensive to get a car loan or to finance a business or to carry a balance on a credit card.
Muslims in the United Kingdom have criticized the country's banking system over its discriminatory policies towards them. Campaigners say British Muslims have been disproportionately denied banking services. They say the banking of British Muslims have been closed without adequate transparency and recourse. The Muslim Council of Britain has written to the Prime Minister, Chancellor of the Exchequer, of opposition parties, and the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, expressing deep concerns over the arbitrary closure of bank accounts belonging to Muslim individuals and Muslim organizations. In the letter, the MCB highlights the recurring issue of banks withdrawing services from British Muslims over the past decade, with adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB said, "We urge for an impartial review that not only addresses the mechanisms behind bank closures, but also examines why British Muslims are disproportionately affected by this issue." The letter also says successive governments have ignored the banks withdrawing services from British Muslims, and the practice had persisted without adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB's intervention comes after figures from Britain's Financial Conduct Authority named Muslims as the only faith likely to be unbanked in Britain. The criticism comes amid the backdrop of a controversy which erupted after a prestigious bank in the UK closed the account of right-wing politician Nigel Farage. He's the former leader of the UK Independence Party, a right-wing political party that campaigned to take Britain out of the European Union. Farage's bank account was shut down by Coutts, owned by NatWest Group, over the alleged disagreement in political views. The boss of NatWest Group apologized for the bank closure. Following the incident, the government announced plans to force banks to explain account closures. Farage had put in a request to the bank to see documents relating to the decision to close his Coutts account.
To the start of this, that it wasn't right for people to be deprived of basic services like banking because of their views. Now, ALT isn't about any one individual, it's about values. Do you believe in free speech and not to be discriminated against because of your legal views?
Critics say the apology and explanation offered to Farage highlights the double standards toward Muslims in the UK. While Farage received a 40-page report regarding the closure of his account, many Muslim charities they have not received the same explanation. Muslim charities have been facing bank closures for decades and are often policed by banks and their policies.
My conclusion is there can really only be one answer. It was Muslims, British Muslims for the most part, who were having their bank accounts removed. And of course, British Muslims don't count. Whereas when Nigel Farage has his bank account removed, that's headlines in the mainstream media, and cue a wave of sycophantic, sob-story columnists coming into action to say, poor Nigel.
In recent weeks, Muslim faith-based charities and pro-Palestine solidarity groups have highlighted they have been subject to bank closures for years as a result of their political views without a major backlash from politicians or the press. HSBC closed the account of Finsbury Park Mosque, and other banks refused to take the mosque custom, despite no law having been broken. Islamic Relief, one of the largest long-standing Muslim charities, was also debanked by HSBC. In 2015, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign had its bank account with a cooperative bank closed. Palestine Solidarity Campaign is the UK's most prominent pro-Palestinian action.
You know, I have people who wept describing the humiliation of it and the consequences for their own families. I've spoken to people whose charity has been wiped out. Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, the Finsbury Park Mosque, very respectable organisation in Islington, North London. The mainstream media totally ignored the story. I often press journalists, friends of mine in the media, please run something about it.
Reports now say the political turbulence plaguing the UK Conservative Party over the last 2 years has slowed its internal efforts to tackle Islamophobia. The study by Swaran Singh, a former Equality and Human Rights Commissioner, has found evidence of discrimination and anti-Muslim views at local association and individual levels.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gaza's health ministry has recently warned that its hospitals are in dire need of tubes for dialysis machines, as well as other essential equipment. The health ministry stated, too, that the Zionist regime has blockaded camera technology used in tests on kidney patients from entering Gaza for most of the past 2 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Nassim loves football. A huge fan of Argentina's Lionel Messi, Nassim used to play everywhere he could, at school, on the street, or a club. Sadly, he has not been able to even take part in kick-arounds lately. Because of his illness, the 10-year-old fears that he may have to give up his beloved game. Nassim's kidneys are not functioning properly, and he has to follow an extremely limited diet. A transplant has been recommended, but so far it has not been possible to arrange one." He asked, "Why am I not like my brothers and sisters? They can eat and drink whatever they want. Why can't I?" Nassim is receiving treatment for kidney complaints at Al-Rantisi Hospital in Gaza City. While the hospital provides dialysis and some medicines free of charge, Nassim's treatment sets his family back almost $100 per month. The bills put the family under considerable strain. Nassim's father is in prison over unpaid debts. Staff Al-Rantisi, the only hospital in Gaza providing children with dialysis, do their best to take care of kidney patients such as Nassim. Yet the complete blockade to which Gaza has been subjected for 16 years now means that they cannot provide an adequate service. Gaza's health ministry warned recently that Rantisi Hospital is in dire need of tubes for dialysis machines, as well as other essential equipment. The health ministry stated too that the Zionist regime had blocked camera technology used in tests on kidney patients from entering Gaza for most of the past 2 years. Dr. Nabil Ayad heads the nephrology department at Rantisi Hospital. He says, "Being a doctor is basically a humanitarian job, but in Gaza, we doctors work under inhuman conditions. I'm always exhausted, physically and emotionally. My heart aches for every mother who sees her child suffering." His colleague, Dr. Muhammad At Anbar, notes that the shortages of medicines have forced the hospital into giving lower doses than those recommended internationally. Gaza's health ministry reported recently that hospitals in Gaza are working at half their capacity. About 40% of medicines and more than 30% of medical supplies are no longer in stock. He says, "Some patients need medicine three times a day, but we can only give them once." Vorud, 14, is another child being treated at Rentisi Hospital. She needs medicines to aid calcium absorption and for other purposes that are currently unavailable in Gaza. Her mother, known as Umme Muhammad, is distressed at Vorud's ill health. Vorud is Arabic for flowers. Her mother said, "My flower is no longer blooming." Both Vorud and her father require dialysis for kidney problems. Her mother said, "My three children and my husband are sick. It's very difficult. Nobody helps me. I have to do everything myself." Tala, 13, has maintained a strong sense of humor despite being unwell for a number of years. Her favorite subject at school is English, and she hopes that one day she will be a language teacher. She joked, "I have traveled a lot to the next neighborhood." As her mother is busy looking after her younger siblings, Tala's sister, Marwa, frequently accompanies her when going to the hospital. Marwa said, "I'm her elder sister and second mother." Asil, also 13, had to stop attending school because of her illness. Her father, Mahmoud, said, "Dialysis takes hours. Asil spends that time watching cartoons on the phone and trying to take her mind off things. After the dialysis, she's very tired." Maher, 13, has lived for longer than his medical team expected. After his weight started falling, he was diagnosed with a kidney problem when he was just 5 months old. A doctor predicted he would be dead within the following 6 months. Despite defying expectations, Maher remains ill. His mother brings him to Rentisi Hospital for dialysis three times a week. So far, it has not been possible to arrange a transplant for Maher. His mother, known as Umme Hafez, said, "I got married at 16 and now I am 24. Adding, "I have spent what should have been the best years of my life in the hospital. I just hope this nightmare will end soon." Arab News website also wrote in this regard, "The Palestinian Ministry of Health has accused the Israeli regime of banning necessary medical equipment from entering Gaza Strip hospitals for more than 2 years. The Hamas-run ministry in Gaza said the lives of patients in Gaza are at grave risk because the Zionist regime is not allowing the entry of medical equipment. The ministry said that the Zionist regime's ban on medical diagnostic devices was a violation of Palestinians' right to treatment, which is guaranteed by international humanitarian law. Patients also suffer while waiting for a pass from the occupied territories to Al-Quds and the West Bank, with dozens of them facing the Israeli regime's security bans. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights warned of the serious repercussions resulting from Israel's continued block on important equipment, which is needed to save the lives of thousands of patients in the Gaza Strip hospitals.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the use of crying and mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein after 1400 years? Why are you disseminating sadness, crying and tears among people? They complain. This is not sadness and tears for the sake of sadness and tears. This is for the sake of the values, the things that lie behind the lamentation, beating the chest and the head, and shedding tears are the dearest things that one might find in the treasure trove of humanity, and they are the divine spiritual values. The Shia are trying to uphold the fact that Husayn ibn Ali is the epitome of all these values. The Shia are trying to keep their memories alive. And if the Muslim Ummah keeps Imam Husayn's name and memory alive and follows him, it will overcome all the obstacles and the hardships. And that is why all of us in the Islamic Revolution, in the Islamic Republic, from the highest to the lowest echelons, including the people, the authorities, the senior officials, and our honorable Imam, have relied on the issue of Imam Husayn and the issue of Ashura and people's mourning. The mourning has a symbolic as well as a realistic aspect. It binds hearts together and it broadens knowledge.
Ana mazlum Husayn Ana mazlum Husayn Ana mazlum Husayn Ana mazlum Husayn Ana latshan
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan Ana latshan
I would like to discuss a point regarding the efforts to promote Islam in the month of Muharram. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This is why Imam Khomeini recommended the traditional forms of mourning. The Quranic verses about the role of the infallible Imams are interpreted in three different ways. Vilayat is one of these interpretations. Your guardian can only be Allah and His Messenger and those who believe, who establish worship and pay charity and bow down in prayer. The Holy Quran, chapter 5, verse number 55. Another interpretation is submission and obedience. Obey Allah and obey the Messenger and those in authority from among you. The Holy Quran, chapter 4, verse number 59.
You've done.
your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
From Hollywood to hotel workers to Teamsters to manufacturing and elsewhere, there are so many labor actions in the United States, the mainstream media is calling it a hot labor summer. The problem isn't record heat, but low wages, poor working conditions, out-of-reach interest rates, and shocking levels of inequality amid the revocation of coronavirus-era social programs and unregulated profit hoarding by corporations. In Chicago, healthcare workers were striking for better wages and conditions amid record inflation and years of overwork.
Our members talk about all the time, does administration know how much the cost of a gallon of milk is, how much the cost of a dozen of eggs, you know, really is when you go to the store? It's just not adding up for them. They're having to pull double shifts, which is, you know, 12, 16-hour shifts in order to be able to pay their bills.
In the largest mass layoff event since 2020, 30,000 workers and their households are now out of a paycheck after shipping giant Yellow declared bankruptcy on the eve of a labor strike. The administration of Joe Biden refused Yellow a bailout of around $1 billion, although he spent $23 billion to save two banks earlier this year and sends over $1 billion per week to fuel the unrest in Ukraine. Yellow employees registered their disgust.
We were going to go out on strike. We give them another 30 days to try to get their stuff together. And they forfeited. Of course, they're trying to sue the union, which is a joke. Shame on them. They got to lay their head down on the pillow at night, what they squandered all this money away.
Corporate bankruptcies have hit their highest first half levels since 2010. And many say forcing a recession to bring down inflation is the true goal of the federal interest rate hikes, despite the damage it's already having on the average worker's household and the economy.
We understand that it's not just hospital workers, but it's a wave throughout the country in regards to a small group of people having the power and making these decisions to really not benefit the majority, but the small minority of individuals that are not having the troubles our members are paying their bills.
Widespread strikes in the United States? That's something many Americans have never seen, and certainly their mainstream media isn't spending much time talking about the labor uprisings. But the post-corona landscape is being defined by economic difficulty and social unrest. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to four counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most